I'm Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview. On today's show, I'll talk to Kent Crowley, author of Long Promised Road, Carl Wilson, Soul of the Beach Boys, the biography. Stick around and keep those good vibrations coming my way, Barbara Ann. Is it fair to call Carl Wilson the accidental Beach Boy? He was the youngest brother and cousin in the world's most enduring and prominent California surf band, the one that probably had other youthful pursuits in mind when older brother Brian recruited him to the band in the early 1960s at about the age of 15. But the rest of the Beach Boys were lucky he got around, came around, as Carl eventually became the band's musical director, lead vocalist, and its conscience in the absence of brother Brian. In his new biography, Long Promised Road, Carl Wilson, Soul of the Beach Boys, writer Kent Crowley tells the story of the brother who spent much of his life in Brian's shadow, even when Brian was nowhere in sight for years and years. Know the Beach Boys' music, but not their history? Maybe you didn't realize those are Carl Wilson's vocals in your head from the immortal Beach tunes Good Vibrations and God Only Knows, among many others. Kent Crowley, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you, Mr. Andelman, and again, thank you for allowing me to be part of this wonderful program.
Delighted to have you here. Accidental Beach Boy, fair to say?
In answer to your question, yes. Carl was impressed into service as a vocalist by Brian and his mother when he was growing up. Brian and the whole family recognized his gifts early on, and I think he did it willingly. I don't think he was reluctant at all. Because in the Wilson family, as you know, the Wilson household was fairly dysfunctional. But I think Carl recognized the importance of music bringing peace into the valley. And more importantly, one of the things I tried to point out in my book is, you know, Murray, I think, always saw music as the family business. And the Able Tool Company was just there to pay the bills, and he was far better connected into the Los Angeles music scene than a lot of people realize. A great deal of the Beach Boys always running ahead of the curve for bands that came out in the 60s came about because Murray from the early 50s was very networked into the Los Angeles music scene, very well connected.
Did they have better deals because Murray understood the business, or were their deals no better, no worse than any other bands?
I think what you really have to start looking at is, and this is the big controversy, of course, is the publishing. Murray, they were the first band to have their own publishing, and that gave them a tremendous amount of flexibility and resources that other bands did not have at the time.
Although, now we should point out that, just to clarify, that Murray was Brian, Dennis, and Carl's father.
Yes.
That's who we're referring to. So did he, but he got to be kind of a pain in the ass after a while. I mean, pardon my French, but they tired of his being part of things pretty quickly.
Well, again, Murray was a very damaged individual. And he, too, had grown up in a very abusive household with an abusive father. So what didn't happen in the Wilson household, really until Carl showed up, was you never had anyone to break that cycle. And that's why I think there was such an emphasis on Carl being the caregiver and the caretaker. Because, again, you're looking at a family with a lot of damage, a lot of issues, a lot of problems. And the one thing that brought that family together was music, unlike anything else.
How would you explain that, as we start focusing on Carl, how would you explain the different roles that Brian, Dennis, and Carl played in that household?
Brian was the eldest son, the golden child. He displayed a gift for music very early on. And I think Murray saw Brian as the as sort of the heir to the family business of making music. Dennis, of course, was the middle child. And when families with two sons, you've got the heir and the spare. And I always regarded Dennis as sort of the patron saint of second-born sons, he and Jack Kennedy. The attention that they don't get becomes the freedom that the other children don't get. And they usually get to indulge themselves. Excuse me. And in Dennis's case, he indulged himself greatly. But he was very talented. And people didn't realize how talented he was until as Brian receded into illness. Like Carl, Dennis started picking up some of the songwriting reins and did a wonderful job. With Carl, I think you had someone whose gifts were, I don't know if I could call them equal to Brian's. I certainly couldn't call them equal to Brian's. But I would say greater than anyone else in the band, absent Brian. And he was a quick study. And everything he did, every time he was asked to do a job, he did it. He took on every detail they threw at him. And that's the reason that when I set out to write this biography, and I hesitate to call it a biography. It's more of a musical analysis. And boy, do I get in trouble for not putting that on the cover. But Carl Wilson presents some very unique problems to someone who is going to chronicle his life. Because as a musician, as an artist, so much of what he did has gotten overlooked in the past or credited to other people. And one of the things that I was so grateful for, thanks to David Beard at Endless Summer Quarterly, Craig Slowinski, the wonderful historian, for years there's been this myth going out that the Beach Boys basically played the songs that Brian recorded in the studio at the Wrecking Crew. And that isn't true. That up until Pet Sounds, that's Carl Wilson. And he's not only doing those wonderful, tasteful solos, he was very much a pioneering guitar player coming out of the surf guitar era. And if you notice, it's Carl's choice of guitar that defines those first two eras of the Beach Boys up to what we refer to as the Smile era. And his production work, particularly in the wake of Wild Honey and Friends, the final Capitol albums, particularly on the albums that basically brought them back to life, which is the Brother Reprise years, which is Sunflower, Surf's Up, Carl and the Passions, and of course Holland. Because what they did was they went from the heights to the depths, and then they came back and reclaimed a whole new audience. And I was very fortunate to have seen a lot of those shows. That was during my musical coming of age. And I was able to see so many of those shows during that period. And those records were amazing records. I know Rolling Stone said of Sunflower when it came out, this is a record that can finally stand the Sunflower. And most of that was Carl. Again, he had all the Beach Boys there, and they were a lot more talented than people have given him credit for over the years, in large part because, you know, the paper trails have been manipulated, mostly because at the time those paper trails were made basically to keep the record companies away from the artists so that they could create. And so they were more of a smokescreen to prevent interference. But over the years, Carl's contributions, particularly his musical contributions, have been obscured or subsumed. They've been sort of rolled into Brian's legacy or rolled into the Wrecking Crew legacy. When in fact, Carl played an incredible, you know, there were two people that Brian went to before he'd released a piece of music. First one was Carl Wilson to make sure it was good, trusted Carl implicitly. And the other one was Hal Blaine. And Hal Blaine basically, when Hal said it was rhythmically correct, Carl said it was a great piece of music, that's when it went public.
So I'm getting a sense of it, but specifically, what inspired you to do a whole book about Carl Wilson? I mean, everybody knows Brian. Everybody's been, you know, the story of Dr. Landy, and everybody knows that. Or they know what they know. They know what they care to know. I mean, I can't see. I don't, maybe someone's done a book on Mike Love or Al Jardine, but I mean, of all the people in music who need a biography, Carl doesn't pop to the forefront. So what is it that convinced you that people needed to know his story?
Actually, I have to give credit to my publisher, Jawbone Press, my editor, John Morish, and my project supervisor, Tom Seabrook. They recognized that no one had ever written a biography of Carl. And in fact, I think in his lifetime, Carl only had two profiles in guitar magazines. And they realized that in a previous book that I had written called Surf Beat, I had written a great deal about Carl. Because if you look at surf music as the music, an expression of this generation that discovered the beach and this new sport, redefined California, people point to Dennis and go, aha, the real Beach Boy, because he surfed and Brian didn't. But if you look at surf music for what it was, and that was an electronic revolution, this is the point at which the amplifier and the effects become the voice of the electric lead guitar, and that is the point at which the lead guitar becomes the voice of rock and roll. And it's a very clear line of demarcation and starts down in Balboa and in the South Bay, where the Beach Boys grew up, in the late 50s and early 60s. And it came about because Leo Fender had a very different approach to designing his technology. And he was basically using all those old surf bands to research and design his new designs. And this is where we find the beginning of playing the amp. That leads us to the introduction of electronic effects. That leads us to sustain. Sustain is the holy grail. That lifts the guitar out of the percussion category, which a guitar is a percussion instrument. Once you can sustain notes, it can now compete with reeds and strings and other instruments. So it was very important, and there's been a debate over the years as to whether or not the Beach Boys were a real surf band. And by every measure in the year that David Marks was in the band, they were certainly a surf band. And this is one of the reasons that I want to make the point of, that I accepted the challenge to write in a very small amount of time a biography of a man who had never been properly chronicled at all. And people need to know Carl was very much one of the pioneers of this idiom. And what he did was every time a challenge was handed to him, every time a gauntlet was thrown, he caught it. And unfortunately, the cost to Carl was he never really got his due as a pioneering guitar player. When in fact, back to the original definition, surf music is electronic revolution, then it's Carl, not Dennis, who's the real Beach Boy.
You met Carl once, right?
I did indeed. I had the great fortune of meeting Carl the night of his debut at the Roxy Theater. And I had met all the other Beach Boys over the years. As a matter of fact, I used to sell groceries to Brian Wilson when he was living in Laguna Beach with his cousin Stanley. Stanley Love, Mike's brother, wonderful guy. Carl was the only one that Carl and Al were the only two that I hadn't met at the time, and I got to go to the Roxy Theater, sat right in front of the stage, got to go backstage and talk to him for a while, and it was very funny because we started talking about fingernails versus flat picks, and he was so sweet, he allowed me to monopolize his time talking guitar trivia on what may have been one of the most important nights of his career. And it was great because you walk in, we were standing at the top at the dressing room of the Roxy, and on the right-hand side, you looked in, and Audrey Wilson was sitting there surrounded by Wilson family members holding court, and on the other side, Jerry Schilling was his manager at the time. So Jerry Schilling had the whole West Coast faction of the Memphis Mafia there. And I walked up just as Carl was saying goodbye to Dennis. I got to talk to Dennis briefly. And it was a very big night. And in the midst of all of this, the guy had time to sit there and show me his fingernails and show him the type of picking technique that he used specifically for this album. Wonderful man.
It's funny how it turned out to be a very important night for both of you.
It did indeed. Again, normally I would not have taken on a challenge like this, which is to write a biography of someone whose legacy has been overlooked for years. But I thought, you know, I was there. I got to see this. I got to see the guy during his most important years. And I, the worst thing that can happen is they can burn the manuscript and tell me to go home. You know?
It's true. It's true. I want to go back. We talked about Murray Wilson, Carl's dad, a bit. Where was Mama Wilson in the 60s? I was thinking about it as I was reading the book. She's kind of a ghost in the story. She, you know, we get a taste of her early on, and she maybe a little bit later, but she doesn't really have a lot of face time in the book.
Audrey was, you know, everybody says that Dennis inherited Murray's volatility, Carl inherited Audrey's sweetness. Audrey's big contribution, and I did mention this in the book, Audrey's big contribution to the Beach Boys was she gave all the guys lessons in boogie-woogie piano, which is a very different piano style than the kind of piano styles that most guitar players start with. And that very much formed the foundation of Brian Wilson's writing style. And that's what makes Brian Wilson's songs very difficult to play and especially to adapt to guitar. Because it's kind of a counterintuitive approach. Normally with a piano, for most people, especially self-taught pianists, which is most of your guitar players who become keyboard players are, generally they will mirror the right-hand chord on the left, or they'll play octaves of the root note. Brian, on the other hand, he kept the rhythm going with chords on one hand, but then he was playing different bass melodies on the other hand. So in a song where you'd go four bars in C, with Brian, it might be four bars with a dozen different chords there. And I know that I spent some time with Stan Ross and Dave Gold of Hollywood's Gold Star Recording Studios. And they were honored by the Grammy Museum in 2009. And Brian actually sent the members of his band down because he couldn't make it himself to be part of this, and something for which they were forever grateful. But I even asked, and I can't think of his name right now, the leader of the band. I said, is it true that the song, this whole world goes through so many permutations, no one can say with any certainty what the key is? And he looked at me and he said, I think so. I said, well, if not, what's the key? He says, you're right. And Audrey, and again, this book, and I get in a lot of trouble for this, it's concerned with music. It's a book about a musician. And I was looking at their everyone's musical contributions. And Audrey made one of the most important by being one of the big influences on Brian. And I made sure that was mentioned in the book, because that's overlooked in a lot of books. And again, with Boogie Woogie, the Boogie Woogie piano style, it's a two-voice style, very complex. And if you're a guitar player and you've ever played in a band with a musician, with a keyboard player who plays in this style, it's difficult because you have to pay very close attention. You can't just sit there and strum an open chord, because all you're going to do is cause problems. I know. And that was one of the other reasons that I decided to accept this challenge. Is that I once played in a band with a keyboard player who everything he knew, he learned from Brian Wilson. And so I had a real affinity with Carl because I knew what he had gone through trying to translate these keyboard parts into guitar parts. And it's fun, it's challenging, it ain't easy.
You obviously know a thing or two about musicianship and quality of musician. Where does Carl rank? Where does his playing, instrument playing rank among, you know, modern pop?
Well, the first thing you have to understand is he started out as a teenager, still in high school, mm-hmm. playing surf music. Surf music begins, as an entry-level style of guitar. But over time, and particularly as the amplifier technology develops, as they introduce the reverb, there are artists like most notably Dick Dale, one of Carl's heroes, Eddie Bertrand, Norman Sanders, Jim Masner. There were these great, great guitar players. And surf music very rapidly, especially because the signature technique is very difficult. It's not just physically difficult to play, but it's even more difficult to keep the meter correct while you're playing and keep it from sounding like a train wreck. Surf guitar players are always walking a tightrope, and they ain't got no net. And Carl was very much, for his age, a superior surf guitar player. Over time, gradually, he came back from that point because the complexities of Brian's writing demanded that Carl command a much higher level of knowledge about chords, rhythms, and not just the chords that they were playing, but the role that each note played in the chord, which a lot of guitar players don't need to know. And as the amps get bigger, you're able to sustain tones, it becomes less important. But with Brian, it was the placement of those notes that determined the type of chord that he was playing. And so, like I said, Carl basically went from being a surf guitar player, which got them in the door and got them on the ground floor of a musical movement that they later redefined, to basically, he wasn't a jazz guitarist, but he took on the same challenges as a big band guitarist would have. And he still, I remember going to see the Beach Boys at the Whiskey Go Go, during the famous Whiskey Go Go tour when Brian joined him briefly. And they did Riot and Cell Block 9, which later became Student Demonstration Time. And Carl cut loose with a solo that, I'm telling you, flattened every guitar player in the room. He could still do it. But again, he saw his role as weaving together this new, very complex music. And he did it beautifully. And as I said, up until about Beach Boys today, the defining sound of the Beach Boys is Carl's clean Fender sound. The defining sound of the Beach Boys becomes the 12-string guitar. You know, 12 strings are hard to play. Oh, God, are they hard to play.
And hold.
Really?
All right, so we've talked about his musicianship. I want to talk to you about his singing. What I'd like to do is have you maybe comment in whatever way you like about a couple of these songs. I'm gonna name two Beach Boys songs, they'll be very obvious, that he sang lead on, is known for, and then I'm going to ask you to pick a third. So tell me a little bit about Carl on Good Vibrations.
Oh, wow. I don't think there's anything to say. That voice is absolutely angelic. I mean, I assume that when you get to heaven, that's how the angels are going to sound, if you get there. It is so beautiful. And again, the whole point of Good Vibrations is the fact that this is a very airy type of thing. It's about sensory overload. It's not just a simple declaration of love. It's a guy kind of being part of the air that this person breathes. And he does it so beautifully. You almost get the sense of this vocal, like her perfume, wafting along the air. I don't think anybody could have done a better job. Nobody on the planet.
All right. And then the other obvious one, of course, is God Only Knows.
Again, he sings. He has such an innocence in his voice. He's got such a purity of tone and such a gentleness. And I think that's the thing that really resonates with people is, you know, with the wrong voice on it, God Only Knows, that song is so delicate, that melody is so delicate, it could not support a rougher vocal. And Carl gets it, and like his guitar solo, he is able to give it just what it needs to carry the message, never overburdens it, never does too little, never does too much. It's always perfect. It's always in the pocket, as they say.
All right, now, here, I think this will be fun for you. Pick a song that Carl Wilson sang lead on, either a Beach Boys song or a solo song, that you want to draw people's attention to, that you think has been overlooked.
Oh, okay. You asked for it. There was an album released in 1980 by the great Stephen McFarlane. And it has since been lost in the ether. And there is a track of the Beach Boys singing Ray Charles's What'd I Say? And Carl is singing lead, and Mr. McFarlane, God bless him, he confirmed for me that that was Carl. Since that time, it has never been available, except on this one particular album, which I believe was only available in Australia. But it is on YouTube. So everybody needs to go to YouTube and type in the Beach Boys, What'd I Say? I believe it's at Sydney or Perth, Australia, 1964. And listen to this man cut loose. We think of him as a sweet, wonderful, angelic guy. This man could kick ass.
All right, excellent.
All he had to do was give him a ticket, and he would write it.
Good, good. You know, I've never asked the question in quite that way, and now I'm going to have to bring that up for other people because you handled that with aplomb. Excellent. Now, I want to turn it around a little more. Very interesting to me to read about non-Beach Boys songs that Carl lent his vocals to. I thought this was very interesting. I'd be curious. I actually picked these off of – I grabbed these off of Wikipedia in a hurry. So you can tell me if any of these are wrong because, of course, it's Wikipedia. They're not necessarily reliable. Chicago's Baby, What a Surprise.
Okay. You'll have to pardon me. I should be a lot more aware of the vocals than I am. With Chicago and the Beach Boys were singing, I tended to hear Carl's part. And again, with Carl, his vocals, when he did songs like that, and Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me by Elton John.
That was the next one on my list, yep.
And all of those. Again, he was there. He gave the song just exactly what it needed. It's really hard because he almost like with Chicago when he was singing with them, like on Wishing You Were Here, he knit his vocal, he wove his vocal so well into the song, it never stands out. You know, this isn't Steve Stills.
Right,
you know,
right?
This is a man who knew just exactly what to give a piece of music. He had exquisite taste.
Does the fact that he was brought into these songs to sing, that speaks to the respect that other musicians had for him?
Clearly. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And again, that was one of the points I tried to make with the book was, you know, after the debacle Smiley Smile and Monterey, Beach Boys sort of fell off the face of the earth. And it was Chicago. And it's only because I can't hear the song in my head, so I can't recall it.
I won't sing it.
As a matter of fact, I went to high school with Tristan Bowden, who's their drummer now.
Oh.
Graduated in the same class.
Wow.
But getting back to the question, it was bands like Chicago. It was artists like Elton John who came back and openly bespoke the influence the Beach Boys had on them. It kind of made everybody give the Beach Boys a second look. And I distinctly remember that because, like I said, first time I saw the Beach Boys, 1970, Whiskey A Go-Go. I think there were probably 1,000 people in the club. Last time I saw them was a stadium in Rancho Cucamonga, you know? And what I thought was interesting was from that first concert at the Whiskey, I was the youngest guy in the room. 4 years later, I saw them at the Long Beach Auditorium. And I looked around, and I'm only 4 years older now. And I look around, and people are bringing their kids.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is why I felt it was so important to get Carl's musical contributions delineated, get them out there for people to see. They've been overlooked for so long. And as I explain to younger musicians and younger people, you may not be influenced by the Beach Boys. You may not listen to the Beach Boys. But I can promise you, you are influenced by someone who was influenced by the Beach Boys. You need to know this. And that's why I say the whole objective of this particular book, it was to finally examine Carl's critical contributions to some of the most important music of the 20th century. And I say most important rather than best or greatest. I'm going to quote Pete Townsend, who, as you know, is no fan of the Beach Boys. But he always said that the Beach Boys were so critical in telling the world how important the recording studio was. And they were especially critical in developing this notion of the recording studio as an instrument. And people need to understand that now, because that's what happened to symphony orchestras. Everywhere you look, you read people saying symphonies are dying, symphonies are dying. No, it's on your iPod. Because when you hear Pet Sounds, when you hear Sunflower, you're listening to a young, bunch of young guys in their 20s with the musicians that they chose, being able to create through technology the perfect environment for this music. And it lives forever. This isn't like the old days where your mom bought sheet music, came home, and sang it to you.
Well, there was one other song that I was just going to mention, and you don't have to comment on it, but there was one. It was interesting that Carl sang on David Lee Roth's cover of California Girls. That surprised me. I did not
know that. Now, that one I can not only hear in my head,
yeah.
I can see it. I did a wonderful interview with Alan Boyd and Mark Lynette, and I asked him, that's the correct way to pronounce his name. Wonderful, wonderful guys. And he told me that when it came time to record that, Carl had to bring a cassette of the Beach Boys' original version, because he said that it had changed so much over the years that he actually had to go back and kind of refresh his memory of how it was supposed to be. But I thought that was great, and that's one thing that kept coming up in all the interviews about Carl, was his sense of humor. And he had a wonderful sense of humor. Steve Levine, one of the things in this book that I'm very proud of, is that I was able to finally cast a little light on an album that's been very much overlooked by Beach Boys fans, and that's the 1985 The Beach Boys album. And he said that working with Carl was so much fun, because like he'd walk in and say, you know, he didn't like Vegas-y types of vocals. If you listen to the Beach Boys Party, they actually have a little fun with Deuce Coupe doing that. Mm-hmm. And Steve told me that there were times that Carl would walk in the studio and do a take in a completely Vegas lounge singing style. And one time he walked in a gold lamé suit. And there were just little moments like that. And again, that was another one of the litany of things that have always been overlooked in Carl's career. And that's why, like I said, it was a challenge. I still have doubts as to whether or not I should have done it. But I was honored to be able to make the contribution that I made to a man who certainly deserved it. And as I said earlier, I've always regarded Dennis Wilson as sort of the patron saint of second-born sons. Carl has always been sort of the patron saint of the caregivers and the caretakers. You know, the ones that stay home and take care of mom and dad while the others go off and party. And so it was for them as well as for Carl that I wanted to undertake this challenge.
Very nice. Well, folks, listen. You can order Kent Crowley's new biography, if you will allow us to call it a biography, at Musicology. Music analysis. It's called Long Promise Road, Carl Wilson, Soul of the Beach Boys. You can get it from great retailers everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price from MrMedia.com. If you are watching this on MrMedia.com, just below the video on the left or the right, you'll see the cover of the book. You can click on it right now. Amazon can get it to you via drone in about 30 minutes or less, or you could probably just download it as an ebook. It's even faster. If they're not delivering by drone in your neighborhood, you can have it in a day or two, I promise. Now, I know you're not a big social media guy, but can people reach you via a website or Facebook, Twitter, any of that kind of stuff?
I would say to go ahead and try. I do have a Facebook page. I haven't been on it in about – 3 years, but I'll tell you what, I'll go home and fire it up. I am old school to the extreme. Thank God for my wonderful children, like my daughter Courtney.
Hi, Courtney.
You know, they like to bring me into the future kicking and screaming whenever I get a chance.
Got
so
it. All right. Well, Ken Crowley, it was a pleasure to meet you, and Courtney, you as well. thank you very much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
And thank you, and I'm honored for the opportunity. And it's a wonderful, everybody, go on the website, look at all the interviews, especially the one with Stevie Ray Vaughan's manager. It's wonderful.
Mark Proctor, that was a good one, yeah. Well, thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate it.
And thank you, sir.
Recorded live before a studio audience full of people who can't surf but always envision themselves hanging 10 while singing I Get Around in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. And why is it I'm thinking of Jack Benny now that I've met the two of you?
That's a good question.
That makes sense.
The Cucamonga connection could be it, though.
Doesn't anyone want to go to Cucamonga? Sorry. I've got the right town, don't I?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Matter of fact, we have a statue of Jack Benny here in Ranch Cucamonga.
So I've heard.
It's over at the Lewis Center. Mm-hmm. And he came out. I was very, very grateful that I was the one that was able to document his visits to Rancho Cucamonga. He was going to put together a golf tour, Anaheim, Azusa, and Cucamonga, and that he died before he could do it. And the guy that originally wrote that line, Fred Balzer, one of Jack's writers, he came up with it because he thought the three cities, because there's no connection to the three other than in the phrase.
Uh-huh.
He thought they just had funny names, Anaheim, Azusa, and Cucamonga. And it debuted in the January 1945 Jack Benny Show, the same one where they debuted the Maxwell and the Underground Vault. And what's really interesting is that phrase, because Mel Blanc used to make the call, now boarding for Anaheim, Azusa, and Cucamonga.
Right.
Prior to that phrase being popularized, there were two pronunciations of Cucamonga. One was Cucamonga, the other was Cucamonga. And it was after the Anaheim, Azusa, and Cucamonga phrase that the K, rather than the Q sound, became the common pronunciation. But I know when I first moved out here, all the old-timers called it Cucamonga.